This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's gun deer season begins on Saturday, and the state's Department of Natural Resources anticipates the hunters out there are going to be older and fewer. This is nothing new. Baby boomers represent the largest cohort of hunters in Wisconsin. The number of them returning to get a gun deer license has been steadily declining for years now. That can have a big impact on how the state manages the deer population and how it funds conservation programs. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you getting ready to go out this weekend for the beginning of the season? Have you been a hunter for years? Is this your first year, or do you think it might be your last? If you stopped hunting a few years ago, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Smith is outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He recently wrote about this topic. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Great to be with you.
I gave the basics there. Can you tell us about this ongoing trend we're seeing of fewer and fewer people each year going out for that deer hunt?
As you mentioned, Rob, it's not a new trend in Wisconsin. We had a peak of license sales for a gun deer license in Wisconsin in 1999. And since then, that number of licenses sold has declined. And probably the single biggest reason is this generation of baby boomers who hunted unlike any generation before or after is starting to age and leaving hunting for a variety of reasons. You know, some of them, it's just a matter of getting older, losing interest, or some move out of state. Some get in health conditions that don't allow them to hunt and or lose access to spots to hunt. There's a variety of reasons, but the bottom line is people aren't coming into the sport like they were in the past. So those the loss of these baby boomers is not being replaced, and we're seeing a net decline in licensed hunters.
I want to talk about what that means in a couple different ways. First of all, part of the state's deer management plan involves a certain number of hunters being out there harvesting deer. Is this decline in the number of hunters affecting that, interfering with that?
It certainly has the potential to. Rob, the gun deer season is the single largest contributor to the hunting account for the DNR. So, you know, and it's still substantial. There's a decline here, but it's important to note that there's still a very large number of licenses sold and participants. This year, it's expected to be around 550,000. And when it peaked, it was about 690,000. So it is down about 140,000, but still substantial. Those licenses sold form the single largest contribution to this hunting-related management in the state. And it's also important because the number of licenses sold is used by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when they're spreading out money from a excise tax on hunting gear, including guns and ammunition, and that's spread around to states. And part of the formula for that is a number of licensed hunters. So it's certainly a concern for the DNR, and it's one I know they've worked to address. You know, there have been active programs called 3R3, recruitment, retention, and reactivation to try to make up for these losses. But so far, the loss has been greater than the new hunters coming in.
Talking about Wisconsin's upcoming deer hunt and a declining number of deer hunters with Paul Smith from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul gave me a great segue there, that R3 program. Emily Eel is with us, hunting and shooting sports R3 coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Now, you've been listening to our conversation so far with Paul. Can you talk about now this R3 effort, the effort to bring more and maybe a different demographics of people into deer hunting?
Yeah. So as Paul mentioned, there's been some really big demographic changes happening in the hunter population. And then there's also been some really big cultural shifts, such as urbanization. There's more people living in cities than ever before. And then just how people value nature and wildlife has changed over the last few decades. So it's pretty unlikely that we're going to reverse the trends that are and the drivers of the decline in hunter numbers. So the goal of our program, the R3 program, is to provide opportunities for people who want to learn. So typically in the past, people would learn to hunt through their family or neighbors, people close to them. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And so our goal is to provide programming and connect people with others who can teach them if they don't have those folks in their network.
You have a few different programs that I think at different levels for people. Can you tell us the different pathways the DNR offers for people who didn't maybe learn to hunt, as you said, from their parents, but want to give it a try?
Yep, we try to provide a large menu of options just because there's no silver bullet for teaching people how to hunt. There's no cookbook, and everybody is at a different stage. So we've done programs anywhere from taking people on 4-hour squirrel hunts on, you know, on weekday afternoons, to programs where we meet multiple times over the course of a month and we spend a really intensive weekend actually hunting with novices. We pair people up one-on-one. And then this year, we've been focusing a little bit more on specific skills. So we've had a lot of fun and success scheduling deer butchering workshops in the different regions throughout the state. So I think we've done 7 of those. And they've been really popular. We've had people coming from hours away, and it's really fun to see the variety of people who come to those programs, because it can be anywhere from people who have hunted their entire lives and are just looking to pick up some tips and tricks on how other people do things. And then we've had classes that are the majority people who have never processed their own deer and who might be complete novice hunters, whether they've gone at all or maybe they're in their first 5 to 10 years of doing that. So it's been really cool to see.
Now, deer hunting season is literally just around the corner, but if people want to get involved in these programs for future hunts, so what do they need to do? Where do they need to go to get set up with this?
So we have an email subscription list, and if you go to the DNR events page, we post all of our events there. So that's always a good place to check out. Otherwise, we partner with a lot of organizations around the state. So we try to post everything on our website, but you can always reach out to me, or we have regional staff. We're excited to bring on 4 new partner positions too, through Pheasants Forever, the National Deer Association, Raised at Full Draw, which is an archery-focused organization, and Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. So reach out to any of us and check out the DNR webpage, and you can find what we're offering.
Emily, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Emily Eel, Hunting and Shooting Sports R3 Coordinator for the DNR. We talked to her about some DNR efforts to offer alternative pathways for people, including younger people, to get into hunting. Paul Smith stays with us, Outdoors Editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, you've been following deer hunting in Wisconsin for a long time. What kind of things do you hear anecdotally, you know, about why the next generation, maybe if you're talking to that baby boomer, why the next generation didn't follow in their footsteps or bootsteps?
Right. Well, I grew up in Racine County here in Wisconsin, and so it was a different time. I'm actually, if you opened up the dictionary and look for the baby boomer deer hunter, you could see my picture, because I'm 62 years old and I'm just right at the peak of this wave that's now passing. And so when I grew up, it was very natural to hunt, and I didn't really have to ask or look very far when I knew I was interested in it. And since then, I've served as a mentor in some of the programs that Emily just mentioned. And so I've got to meet people who have more challenges today to hunt. And I've also served as a mentor to friends and children of friends and et cetera. It's a different world, Rob. You know, it's just a whole different world how people relate to outdoor activities. And hunting is actually, you know, it's another step. It's one thing to go out for a hike and to maybe go bird watching, but to go hunting requires, you know, some extra gear, and it's a different intention. You want to bring an animal into possession, kill it, and bring it home for food mostly. And while there is some motivation there, I see a strong motivation for wild, locally sourced food. Mm. It's still a smaller percentage of the population that wants to do that than, when I was in my teens. So that's the big lift that the DNR and other agencies have, is trying to appeal to younger people today and people of all ages. I've mentored people who are adults too, who are just, you know, adult onset hunters. It's a big challenge. We have to also mention that it's not just in Wisconsin. This is, mm-hmm. this is a nationwide event going on where hunting is declining, or hunting license sales are declining. So, and I think I have a high regard for the programs that are being offered in Wisconsin, but it's just a different era here in 2023, Rob.
Talking to Paul Smith, outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the upcoming deer season. The gun deer season starts this weekend. Fewer hunters, older hunters out there now, according to the DNR. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your story, your question. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the changing demographics of deer hunters in Wisconsin, the largest cohort, baby boomers, then the gradually declining number of gun deer licenses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Timothy is with us in La Crosse. Timothy, hi.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm 78 years old, belong to a mentoring group called CAMEL, Kids and Mentors Outdoors. And there's like five chapters in the state of Wisconsin. Our charge is to try to get kids outdoors, not just hunting, but anything outdoors, from hunting, fishing, canoeing, kayaking, birding, whatever you have. And it's just a difficult problem. To get the kids, and what even more difficult is to get adults, mentors. We're all aging out, and it's hard to find people to join something like CAMEL, Kids and Mentors Outdoors.
And Timothy, before I let you go, Timothy, I wanted to ask, it's just a few days away from the deer hunt, if people want to get involved with that as a mentor or mentee, is it too late, or can they still sign up?
Well, for kids, it's too late to really do anything that way. We do have, at Poinette, we have what we call a Joe hunt. And the kids can, and this is an excellent thing, in the sense that they, at Poinette, state of Wisconsin actually has almost like a dormitory. They have a kitchen where they feed the kids, and they get a chance to hunt. I think it's somewhere around December 7th. They might look into that and try to get kids and mentors together there. But
excellent, Timothy. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, not just the DNR, but other groups around the state working to bring new people on board with hunting and other outdoor activity we just heard.
Absolutely. Dozens of them are in that work, Rob. And I went up and I stayed at the McKenzie Center 1 year with CAMEL, the group that Tim is with, and slept in the dorms and went on deer hunts with them. I'm very familiar with their programs. So there's a lot of people working on the same problem, and people in the conservation community are fully aware of how important it is to help young people and people of all ages to make that connection to the outdoors, whether it's hunting or other things. There's so many positives that can come from it.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Timothy. We'll go to Brad now in Tomahawk. Brad, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Oh, I was just calling in because I heard your radio thing about the diminishing people getting tagged and stuff. And I'm from Tomahawk, and we had a hunting party of probably about five where we haven't seen a deer in probably 5-6 years. In fact, we've seen more wolves, coyotes, and bears then. So there's been a loss of interest.
Brad, I gotcha. Not a great signal, but I get your point. Brad saying they're not seeing deer out there. Paul, looking at statewide deer population numbers, the trends are up, I think, over the last few years, but that doesn't mean in any one particular hunting site, yeah, there's going to be deer there.
Exactly. Yeah. The operative phrase is deer densities vary, even in a local area, and they're not... I think they say distributed evenly across the landscape. And in Tomahawk and other parts to the north, the deer herd there can have effects of severe winters, which either kill deer or reduce survival. And we have more predators in the north also. So one could make an argument that the deer herd is better balanced in the north, a more natural balance. But if you're a deer hunter and you haven't seen a deer up there, that argument doesn't carry much weight. I feel for hunters who want to go out and see deer. That's usually the number one criteria for a successful hunt is actually for deer hunters to actually see a deer, not necessarily kill one. And if you're out there for hours and don't see them, then creates a less satisfying experience, and that can cause people to stop hunting for sure. I've heard from many people who've said they just aren't seeing the deer anymore. And because it takes some effort, you know, especially if you don't live in that area, but you traditionally travel to northern Wisconsin, you might just decide to stay home and spend the weekend closer to home or change your hunting area. Certainly deer populations can affect the number of hunters in an area.
Thanks for the call, Brad. We are talking about Wisconsin's deer hunting season, declining number of people hunting over the course of time in Wisconsin. Paul Smith with us at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And back to your calls now. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi. I had two thoughts. One's related to the camo idea. I'm not a hunter. I'm a fisherman and I belong to Trout Unlimited. And we run a summer trout camp. I know our chapter donates to a summer camp for kids. Doing some things like that and having hunting groups sponsor summer camps or fall camps, maybe a long weekend camp might be a possibility. The other thought is kind of heretical, I think. It's probably heresy. But I'll say it anyway, and that is I used to have a friend, a lifelong friend, who was an avid hunter. And as I said, I'm a fisherman. I live close to Lake Michigan. He lived up in Oneida County. And while I was going to retire and live up there, he was going to teach me to hunt. But unfortunately, he died. When he was still alive, he would share the... his hunt with me, and I would share frozen salmon and smoked salmon with him. And we did it for years, and there's nothing any very formal about it. We just did it. The thought crossed my mind that perhaps there would be a way for people like myself, and I'm in my later 70s, to buy a second ticket for somebody, pay processing costs, and maybe work out something else as an incentive, because wild game is wonderful and I certainly like it, and I've lost my source, and I rather suspect as people are aging out of hunting, they are likewise And perhaps there's something that could be worked out.
Interesting, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, I don't know if anybody's thought of, or proposed things like this, where somebody like John, who doesn't hunt or can't hunt anymore, sponsors that current hunter, buys that second ticket, pays for the processing, so the hunters out there are hunting for two instead of just one.
Fantastic idea. I've never heard it proposed before. I've heard it similar things in different areas of the outdoors. For instance, the federal duck stamp, people would buy two instead of just the one that they need to hunt, but it would just be a way to contribute more to the wetlands fund that the duck stamp supports. But I've never heard anything similar to what John just recommended. I think it's a great suggestion.
Interesting idea, John. Now, Paul, I want to take our last little bit of time. Give a little forecast or what are the conditions looking like for the deer hunt? Not a lot of snow on the ground in most of the state, which I understand is a big factor.
Yeah, it's a big factor because when you have snow on the ground, the deer are much easier to see as a hunter if you're looking across the landscape. If it's going to be brown like it is this weekend and the brown deer are moving, it just makes it much more difficult for hunters. On the positive side, the forecast calls for mild temperatures, so hunters could spend more time afield, and that might help increase their odds of filling a tag. Last year was perfect, just about perfect on opening weekend, and the deer kill was up 14% year over year last year, largely because of the great conditions opening weekend. I will be heading to Madeline Island in the Apostle Islands. It's the farthest north I've ever deer hunted, but I think the conditions are going to be without snow. So I'll see what we can turn up on Madeline Island.
Paul, thanks again for joining us today.
So much. Thank you, Rob.
That's Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about the aging, declining deer hunter population in Wisconsin ahead of the start of the state's gun deer season this Saturday. Still time for you to share your experiences, what's led you to start hunting, stop hunting, or stay in it. If you're a younger person into hunting, love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, did you ever make a mixtape for your crush? Are you the go-to DJ for road trips, parties, workouts, trivia contests? We want to hear from you. We're talking about the history of playlists and how to make your next playlist stand out. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two Appleton sisters and their love of reading.
Beth Lowe grew up spending most of her free time immersed in books. Now living with her sister, Mai J. Lo Lee, she has come to find that her love for reading has had a positive influence on her family, despite how her parents felt about it. The sisters talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
My name is Beth Lowe. I am 49 years old.
My name is Mai J. Lo Lee. I am 43 years old today. So Beth, how does it feel being the older sister and not having an older somebody to go to?
You know, it's funny you say that because on the way over here, we're referencing that you and the younger sisters each had a sibling, a cousin, a playmate that you can hang out with.
Talk boys,
yes,
talk girls.
Talk boys, talk makeup as you transition into your preteen, teen years. And I was just saying, I have nobody in our culture, and we are Hmong. I'm the oldest, so there's never that effort to get friends or people that you can talk to outside of your familial setting. So it was quite lonely growing up being the oldest girl in the family.
Do you think that's why you like books so much?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me why you like to read so much and what do books mean?
I think if you ask anybody who loves books, it's just you get into the page and you become the characters. You become where you go, where they go. You feel what they feel.
You live with me now. You've been living with my family for 2 years, and I cannot tell you, like, how you've normalized reading for my daughter.
Yes.
Because whereas like with her peer group, enjoying reading is not seen as cool. And I try to do it in front of her all the time. But for her, when she saw you do it like during your free time and not watch TV, not use your phone, where you always had a book in your bag or you had a book in every room or a book, like for her, she's like, I can put a book in every free space.
Yeah.
You know, and I just really appreciate that because for you living with us, that's really normalized, like very for her, like it's normal to read. Everybody should read, but it's okay to read whatever you want.
Right.
You know, and for her to like know that that's like normal. Because, you know, in our household, that was not normal.
Right.
We used to get yelled at for reading.
Well, as you remember, our mother would literally come take the books out of our hands and rip it out. And I remember a couple of, I think it was last week, you were asking Senya to go do something. And she's like, Mama, I'm reading. And I think you just silently closed the door and just walked out because what can you say when your child is like, what do you mean I can't? I'm reading.
I felt so triggered when I was like, go do your chores and stop reading. And I thought, trauma. You know,
right.
Like I was like, I had to go journal. I had to go write about like, how do I feel? What is that? Because I remember my mom and our parents yelling at us about reading too much or that this wasn't going to be a skill set that like brides needed.
Right.
You know, and I had to explain to her, like, just so you know, Grandma and Grandpa were not encouraging of us reading. You know, and I remember when you went off to college, my dad had a book burning out in the farm because he was like, what the hell am I going to do with all these thousands of books?
Yeah.
And then he just had this big bonfire and just threw all the books in there. And I didn't realize like what it meant at the time or all of that stuff. But I just thought he burnt books because he didn't want the younger kids to read it or to be influenced by it or to like go to college.
I think you and I, we snuck it in wherever we could. Thinking back to my youth, that was one of the rebellious things that I could have done in terms of from a cultural perspective. Sadly, our mother would never say, we have a daughter who reads. It's always, I have a daughter who reads. So there's that hint of shame in that. And I appreciate you saying that about me influencing your daughter in a small capacity.
Oh, no.
That's beautiful.
That's a big capacity. You know what a big capacity that is.
That was Beth Lowe and Mai J. Lo Lee of Appleton. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, mixtapes, compilations, playlists, whatever you want to call them, people have been making these love letters to their favorite music for decades. And music lovers have a lot of opinions about what makes a good playlist. Here's John Cusack's character, Rob, in the 2000 movie High Fidelity.
Now, the making of a good compilation tape is a very subtle art, many do's and don'ts. You got to kick it off with a killer to grab attention. Then you got to take it up a notch. Then you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules.
Our next guest studies the music streaming industry and is here to share his own rules for making a great playlist. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story about making or receiving an especially memorable mixtape or CD or online playlist from a sibling, friend, a crush? Do you like listening to or making playlists on music apps? Do you have a list for every occasion? What is the key to a great playlist? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Morris is a professor of media and cultural studies in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, where his research focuses on digital music and media. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Did you make or receive actual physical mixtapes or CDs back in the day, or maybe you still do?
Definitely remember making some playlists on mixtapes, like a recording from one stereo to the other, and then moving into the burned CD era, you know, where we're finally able to put songs from computers onto disc. And then, now trying to... I don't make as many now, but trying to stay active on Spotify, making playlists there.
Now, like many things in my life, I do things in kind of a half-baked way. And that's how I did mix cassettes and then CDs and then playlists. Not a lot of thought, not a lot of effort, even though I love music. Do you have rules, hard and fast rules, or like vague guidelines that motivate how you make a set list?
Yeah, I think it's hard. It depends, I think, on the kind of playlist that you're making, right? We have playlists that are kind of units of communication, right? We want to send a message to somebody. And so if that's the case, then yeah, you know, you want to think about how are you going to say, what do you want to express, whether that's to your partner, whether that's to your kid, whatever, whoever you're making it for. You can also think about playlists as sort of sonic resources, right? Is it to score a party or an event that's happening, right? So there'll be different rules that apply depending on the kind of playlist. And then also thinking about playlists as kind of memory, like a moment in time, right? Some people make best of 2023 playlists because they want to remember what they were listening to this year. So I think the rules change depending on the kind of playlist that you're making.
Now suppose, and a lot of that movie High Fidelity was about making that playlist for a potential significant other. I'm really bad with lyrics, so I might pick songs that turn out to be very unromantic or anti-romantic. I wouldn't touch that, but you have thoughts on setting up a playlist with that goal in mind.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part, right? Is music has lots of meanings to it, and people are going to take the songs differently. So it may mean something to you, and you may have crafted the thing that you think is perfect for the person that you're crushing on. It may land completely differently, right? But hopefully what you're sharing is part of your identity, right? These are some of the songs that I like. These are some of the things that mean something to me, or these are something that remind me of you, and this is why I'm putting that together, right? So I think back to those playlists that I made for other people in that way. It was often like, this is a thing that reminds me of us or of moments in our time together, right? So if you can find songs that evoke those moments, that evoke that familiarity, that can be a really, really powerful connection with the person, right? I recently made some for my kids, so, you know, and it was almost like they were just starting to get into music, right? So it was that kind of intimate moment between parent and kid about, like, hey, this is a whole world that happened before you were here. Let's talk about some of that.
We are talking about making mixtapes or mixed CDs or playlists for ourselves or to share with others for different occasions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite memory or if this is something you do all the time now, whatever technology you use, love to hear about it at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Clint Walls from PBS Wisconsin sent us this memory of making mixtapes.
I go back to the days of mixed cassettes, and the order and the flow of the songs are really the key. But in addition to those things, you really do need to keep it interesting. For all my mixtapes that I gave to friends, I'd include a message from children's read-along 45s, like this.
You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the chimes ring like this.
Throwing in those little curveballs like movie quotes recorded from a VHS player, and putting them at the beginning or the end of a tape's side kept things fun and memorable.
The production value, Jeremy, I never did this. I have friends who did, who went in the physical media and the case and sound effects and things like that. Have you gone to that level of mixtaping?
Yeah, so I remember I used to make mixtapes on tape, and we were going to play them in the car as we were driving to the ski hill that was about 40 minutes away from my where I lived. We were listening to rap music. It had swear words in it, and my parents were the ones driving us. So we were actually, as we were recording, we had a microphone set up, and we would cough over the swear words. So we would, like, produce radio edits.
Nice.
During the process so that we could listen to these songs still and hope that our parents didn't really notice.
Now, how much has technology changed? I mean, it was one thing to make a thing on a cassette. That's a big pain. A little easier, I found, with CDs. It almost seems too easy in some ways with some digital media, like, well, that's no effort at all. I don't know. How does that change the philosophy of our mixtapes?
Yeah, I mean, I think making a playlist has always been an art, and that what's changed is the tools we use to make that art, right? And so I think there's some limitations to all technology. And so what's really neat is how people use that technology. So like in the one we heard, right, it's like neat to insert things. It's harder to do that on Spotify. You can't really, you know, just take a movie quote from somewhere and put it in, right? So you have to be kind of creative there. Spotify or iTunes, you know, or Apple Music, they give you access to massive amounts of catalogs. So it's great in that sense, right? You can really mine the depths of popular music history to create a message for someone. You know, but then there's the drawbacks of it, right? Yeah, is it too easy? Or I worry a little bit more about, you know, some of the things about data and the way that playlists are now, you know, designed to help kind of track our behaviors and our sort of patterns, right?
Talking to Jeremy Morris, professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison, talking about making music playlists, from philosophies about what makes a great track list to advice for how you can make sure your next playlist hits all the right notes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have playlists, or maybe ones you shuffle, or actual cassettes or CDs that you listen to when you're working out, when you're cooking, when you're studying, or when you have friends over? Do you make compilations for other people, or do you have a favorite memory of someone who made one for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or do you just like to leave it to an algorithm now? You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
The most important track is number one. It's got to be familiar, but also unexpected. Most importantly, it's got to make you feel good.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a clip from the Hulu TV adaptation of the movie and book High Fidelity, starring Zoe Kravitz, the song David Bowie's Modern Love. Jeremy Morris is with us, media professor at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the art of making the perfect playlist for any occasion, including picking a first track that'll make an impression. You can join in with your memories of making a mixtape, a mix CD, a playlist for a friend, giving or receiving. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller. Jay is with us in Whitefish Bay. Jay, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I had a friend who sold records, and I had a lot of favorite one-hit wonders from the 50s and 60s. So he went ahead and made me I gave him a list of all the songs that I wanted, all the, you know, the one-hit wonders that I liked. And then in 76, when I traveled around the country, I had a group of friends that had tape decks that were able to make tapes for me of classical music and all the albums that I really liked. And it made traveling around the country much more enjoyable and always kept me close to home.
Fantastic. Jay, I want to make clear, your friend actually burned a vinyl playlist for you of your favorite one-hit wonders?
It was on not a vinyl.
Okay.
It was on a tape.
Okay.
And I still have it now. It's been like, it's, 40-some years old, and it's still...
The cassette still works.
40 years ago.
That's pretty good. I had tapes that disintegrated after a year or two. Jay, thanks a lot for that call. I love that story, but also traveling around the country and swapping mixtapes with friends. I don't know if that's something that people do anymore. I love that concept, though.
Yeah, no, and again, these things are memories of places, of who we were, of where we were, right? So, like... music is so intimately connected to our memories of ourself that, like where you are when you're listening, if you remember a particular music scene that was in the city you lived in, right? All of that stuff's really important.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Heard from a couple people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carol writes, when a friend got divorced, I had a CD made for her of every possible version of I Will Survive. It was great fun. Carol, thanks a lot for sharing that. There's that that theme, but also sending a message.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love also setting the parameters mm-hmm. of this, right? Like, the other great thing you can do with thinking about a playlist is, what are the parameters that you're going to adhere to as the creator of this playlist? So I just made a playlist that was called Long Songs, and it was everything had to be over 7 minutes long, because I wanted to just drive my family crazy when I listened to it, because they don't really like songs that go on that long, right? But, setting parameters like that can be a real kind of creative spark for you.
Did Inagata DeVita by Iron Butterfly make the list at 17 plus minutes?
I should. I got to go back and add it.
Because they'll love that.
Yeah.
It's a favorite of mine. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Evan is with us in Madison. Evan, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your mixtape story?
Well, mixtapes have been a part of my life forever. It's how I've gotten many girlfriends. How else are you supposed to express your feelings without, being a confident person?
Evan, what's the secret? What's the secret to having the perfect first song on a mixtape to impress that potential significant other?
You have to know what they like as well.
Got it. Evan, thanks a lot for the call. Going with your audience, I think my mistake on mixtapes is here's a bunch of songs that I like. Hope you like them too, rather than putting my audience in mind.
Yeah, no, they're definitely a form of communication, right? And any form of communication requires both telling and listening. Yeah, so.
Evan, thanks a lot for sharing that. I appreciate it. Tim on Facebook writes, I've been doing this for decades. I love music of a lot of flavors, and I like to construct things that either have themes or some sort of sonic trip or a surprise. Interesting. So Tim does it a lot of different ways. I don't know your thoughts on developing a theme and or a flow in a mix, a compilation, Jeremy.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And again, you know, you said you're not really big on lyrics, right? I'd say the same for me. But, you know, you can see people who will do playlists that are all based on a kind of lyrical progression throughout the thing. Personally, I sort of go with mood, like what are the, you know, is this a guitar song? Is it really upbeat? Then that has to be followed by another one like that. Is this the calm part of the you know, so, and how do you get from those calm sections to the louder ones? Everybody's going to have a different take on how to do that successfully. But I think a good playlist feels like it makes sense when one song comes after the other because of the tone, because of the instruments, because of the genre of music, right?
As a musician, I've played in bands with people who had very strict rules about song sequencing. Two rocking ones, then a slow one, or never play a song in the same key back to back, or things like that. Do you think that rules like that, and I don't know if they make any sense. I don't know if anybody actually cares, but do you have rules like that in mind when you're making a list?
I don't, because I think that the best playlist will surprise you and will break those rules, right? And so that, again, that clip of somebody throwing in the children's records or, you know, you know, that kind of stuff is exactly what will sort of surprise you. But yeah, I generally think about mood and how you want the playlist to go. You can have a whole playlist of sad songs, right? And it can be in this space. You don't necessarily have to have dynamics, right? So there, I don't know if there's rules. There is a feeling that a playlist evokes, and everybody's particular take on that feeling is what makes the mix and the playlist unique.
Now, Maureen McCollum here at WPR told us a lot of her playlist memories are from dance parties, and she has an interesting recommendation, Music League, a website that invites groups of friends to submit songs based on a common theme that vote on the tracks. So it's a perfect combination, she says, of collaborative and competitive. Jeremy, what do you think? I hadn't heard about that, this idea of collaborating online to create these playlists.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that new digital playlists do allow that's really interesting. Spotify has a feature like that as well, where you're able to make a playlist with friends in real time, right? So it's really neat that you could have a party where everybody's connected to the same system and the playlist is like the jukebox at the bar before, right? You know, so we've had examples of those things in the past, like the jukebox, but this sort of brings it to that personal, to that intimate level where friends are collaborating and as was said, they're competing in some cases, right? Like because there's a voting mechanism there, right? So it's always going to be an interesting experiment when you're collaborating with multiple people with a variety of different tastes, and you're going to create something great.
And our own Rochelle Wilson, producer here on Central Time, pointed toward a Facebook group called Oddly Specific Playlists. 360,000 members. Requests range from 90s country wine mom vibes to songs that make you feel like you're taking a leisurely drive through outer space to gaze at all of the planets and stars. Have you ever gotten that specific with a playlist, Jeremy? Except for your 6 minute plus one.
Yeah, the 6 minute one is one. I had a playlist that a friend created for me, which is like, I've already given up on trying to get back into baseball, you know? And so like, there are times where I think you can play around with the title of it. But yeah, no, that group, that Facebook group is a wonderful example. And again, you see that on other digital media too, like Netflix, the way that it tailors content to us in such specific ways. I don't think it's surprising that we react by doing that ourselves when we're creating things.
And finally, Jeremy, quick question. You've made a digital playlist for yourself. Shuffle or linear order?
Depends on the thing. You know, so again, if it's that communication to somebody, it's a message and I'd love to have it received in the order that it was laid out, right? But if you're syncing something for a party or if I'm going for a run and I have a batch of songs that are all at the same pace so that I'm running at the exact same tempo, doesn't really matter as much, right? So I think it's, again, depending on who the audience is, what the purpose of it is.
Jeremy, thanks again for coming up to the studio.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's Jeremy Morris, professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. His research focuses on digital music and media. He joined us to talk about the art of making music compilations from the old days of mixtapes to the streaming services we use today. Keep sharing your mixtape and playlist stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, air travel could be better for consumers, a lot better. That's according to the author of the new book, Why Flying is Miserable. He joins the show with some solutions, plus a new book from Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss. He joins the show as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.